TUC Radio San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Behind the scenes of the UN Millennium Meeting. It is still an open secret that large multinational oil, automobile, and chemical companies are now underwriting United Nations programs. In January of 1999, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan had called for a global compact between the UN and corporations. He asked business leaders to embrace 9 principles derived from UN agreements on labor standards, human rights, and environmental protection. In exchange, he promised, the UN will support free trade and open markets. Now, almost 2 years into the project, the Secretary General is wholeheartedly embracing the WTO, as promised. However, most corporations that are now in partnership with the UN give only lip service to UN principles. In fact, the list includes some of the worst polluters and violators of human rights, such as Rio Tinto, Shell, Chevron, Unocal, BP, DuPont, Nike, and Mitsubishi. These corporations joined the Global Compact on condition that there is no monitoring. They also make clear that adhering to standards of equity, justice, and environmental protection is entirely voluntary. This program explains the UN corporate collaboration and suggests what could be done. Kenny Bruno works with the Transnational Resource Action Center. He has 12 years of experience with Greenpeace and also worked with the National Labor Committee on sweatshops. Kenny Bruno.
If you're about my age and you're from New York, like me, when you were a kid growing up on Halloween, in addition to collecting candy from your neighbors, maybe like my friends and I, we collected pennies for UNICEF in little orange boxes. Every door we went to was trick-or-treat for UNICEF. That was our sing-song. And we were told that we were partners with the United Nations. It felt very good to be a partner with the United Nations. Now, that seems a long time ago. The UN is partnering not with candy-collecting kids, but with giant transnational corporations. The Secretary General Kofi Annan, as you've heard, has spearheaded the highest profile of these partnerships. That's the Global Compact. But almost all the other agencies, the UN agencies, are also forming their own partnerships with corporations. The Environmental Program and the Labor Organization and the High Commission on Human Rights are all part of the Global Compact. The United Nations Development Program has its own partnerships. UNESCO, the Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, the World Health Organization, all of these UN agencies have been encouraged to form partnerships, and they're doing so. The corporations involved, and here is one of the most obvious and disturbing parts, include companies like Nike, Shell, Rio Tinto, Daimler Chrysler, Unocal, and a lot of others who are infamous for environmental degradation and for violation of human rights. When you think about the list of those companies and their notoriety and what they mean to a lot of us, you have to ask yourself the question, why exactly does the UN have to partner with these corporations or with corporations at all? I mean, a partnership means an alliance. Here we have the idea somehow that these partnerships are long-term and that the goals somehow of the private sector and the UN are the same. But as the director of UNICEF has said, Carol Bellamy, it's very dangerous to assume that the goals of the private sector and the United Nations are somehow one and the same, because they most emphatically are not. And what Carol Bellamy is talking about is very obvious. The United Nations is driven by its values of peace and democracy and human rights and so forth, and corporations are driven by the profit motive. They're definitely not the same. In this talk, I want to explore a little bit about why, then, two types of organizations with very, very different goals should partner together. I want to go back to the mid-1980s. For just a couple of minutes. In the 80s, you had a series of environmental catastrophes that really led us to understand how corporations were at the root of many of our worst environmental crises. The Bhopal tragedy was brought to you, in a sense, by Union Carbide. 1984. In 1986, we had the chemical spill in Basel, brought to you by Sandoz. By 1988, we had the hottest summer on record. We had garbage washing up on the beaches of New Jersey. We had the discovery of the ozone hole from 1986 and 1987, brought to you by DuPont and Allied Signal and Herxt and others. So that, and in 1989, of course, the Exxon Valdez spill. So by 1990, the 20th anniversary of Earth Day, you had the corporations really feeling the heat, not only that their reputations were threatened, but actually their bottom line. And the spotlight was really on them. So they invented a strategy to combat it. They responded with a massive public relations campaign to present themselves as the environmentalists, the corporate environmentalists. And the CEO of DuPont at the time said that CEO, his title stood for Chief Environmental Officer. He did say that. And he also had the gall to use the imagery of the environmental movement, the seals and the whales, in the commercials, and even Beethoven's Fifth or Ninth Symphony, I can't remember which. And Sandoz used the sparkling river. I mean, you've all seen these beautifully photographed, beautifully filmed advertisements for cars with lush tropical forests and just gorgeous natural settings and some kind of implication that these companies care, they know all about the environmental problems, and they are doing everything they can to solve it, so don't worry, just leave them be, and they'll take care of it. Now, this phenomenon we call greenwash. Okay, what does this have to do with the United Nations? At around the same time the greenwash PR strategy was born, the UN was organizing the Rio Earth Summit. And at that time, the corporations added an important political element to their greenwash campaign. Borrowing from their co-optation of environmental language, they said to the world, we're not against the Earth Summit. We're for it. In fact, we're the experts in environment. We're the experts in development. We're going to be part of this, and we're going to help you. And they got unprecedented access to the UN through the Secretary General of the Earth Summit, and they formed an advisory group called the Business Council for Sustainable Development, which is now part of the Global Compact, and they played an important and very destructive role, in my view, at the Earth Summit itself. Behind the eco-friendly rhetoric of these business groupings and of these companies was the political strategy of making sure the Earth Summit did not name them, the transnational corporations, as the culprits behind these environmental crises, and rather emphasized voluntary measures that the companies could take over any binding legal agreements. That was their political strategy, and for the most part, it worked. Now, we go to the mid-90s, and we go through a similar process. A number of corporations come under fire for human rights violations. Shell, in the case of Ken Saro-Wiwa and his colleagues, as was mentioned. Unocal and Total, two other oil companies complicit in human rights violations in Burma. And Nike and many, many other companies for sweatshops abuses all around the developing world. So I guess they kind of thought to themselves, we had a problem like this once before. It was around environmental issues, and our greenwash strategy worked pretty well. So as you probably guessed by now, they copied that strategy, and they invented the blue wash strategy, which is where you wrap yourself in the flag of the United Nations, which is blue, of course, blue also being the color of labor, and you start talking about, on your home pages and in your annual reports, talking about your commitment to human rights, reproducing the Universal Declaration of Human Rights on your home page and so forth. And this is what they've done. If you visit the home pages, you see this human rights rhetoric alongside the environmental rhetoric. And through these partnerships, through the use of the human rights rhetoric, and especially association with the UN, they get to blue wash themselves, wrapping themselves in the flag of the UN, without making any commitment to real changes, without making any real commitment to abide by the principles of human rights. That's very important, because they're staying inside the UN with these partnerships, where they can make sure that everything stays on a voluntary basis. Now, what about the UN? What's in it for them? There are two major answers. One, they're very scared of irrelevance. They've been marginalized in the process of globalization. Even as the corporations have weakened the UN and made sure that most of their agreements stay voluntary, they've carried out their real agenda at the WTO and made sure that those agreements have some real teeth. When was the last time you ever heard them say, oh, free trade and liberalized investment, that's a very nice idea and everybody should voluntarily follow that? No, they don't do it that way for investment agreements. They only do it that way for environment and for human rights. But the second reason that that the UN is vulnerable to wanting to do these partnerships is pressure from the U.S. The U.S. has held back the dues that it owes, and it's no secret that part of the requirement for paying up is that the U.N. become more business-friendly, and the U.N. feels it cannot defy the U.S. on this point. And so the partnerships. Now, the partnerships do have, on the surface at least, a simple and worthy goal, which is to coax private funds into humanitarian causes, into UN agency budgets, because governments aren't giving enough. But the partnerships also have some serious flaws. First of all, it's really the wrong relationship. As I mentioned before, a partnership implies that you have the same goals, and we don't have that here. The UN does have to have some interactions with corporations. There's no doubt about that. They have to buy things, and they have to buy them presumably from corporations. But that does not mean there's a partnership or cooperation with that corporation. Secondly, it's the wrong companies. There is a long list of companies that are part of the partnerships, and I'm not going to go into the record of these companies in detail. There's no time. But if you just take one or two of them, like Nike, practically invented the ugliest side of globalization, where you roam around the earth looking for the lowest wages, looking for the weakest standards. You put your factories there to save a few bucks on manufacturing, and then you put those bucks into advertising, like the swoosh, so you can torture us all when we watch the U.S. Open and you can't avoid seeing the swoosh. That's Nike. Shell, we really don't have to go into this, but if you look at the list of corporations, it's terrible judgment on the UN's part to partner with some of these corporations. The third flaw of the Global Compact I want to mention is the wrong image. You know, as the UN Development Program puts it, when a UN agency is involved in a PR activity with a corporation, a mutual image transfer inevitably takes place. So they mean that the image of the company rubs off on the UN and vice versa. And imagine, let me just digress for a minute to talk about one of these partnerships to give you an idea of what I mean. It's one that really gets my goat, even though it's not a major partnership. It's between UNESCO, the Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, and their corporate partners are Disney and McDonald's. And the partnership is to give out Youth Millennium Dreamer Awards, and they did this in Disneyland in May. Now, I don't know, I'm trying to teach my children, for example, that the UN is a good thing, but McDonald's may not be such a good thing. Maybe they shouldn't eat too much McDonald's, or for that matter, watch too many Disney movies. So to mix these up, and for UNESCO to be somehow having the same values as McDonald's and Disney when they're giving out these Dream Awards, to me is really wacky. Anyway, sorry for that digression. The fourth flaw of the Global Compact is there's no monitoring and no enforcement. The companies get to join without making a commitment to change, and they've made it clear through the International Chamber of Commerce that this lack of monitoring and the lack of enforcement is a prerequisite for their participation. So it's a little like saying, okay, we have a robbery problem, and we really can't ever hope to stop all these robberies, so we're going to bring all the biggest robbers up here and ask them to promise not to rob anymore. That's what the Global Compact is doing, in a sense, with some of the biggest corporate criminals. Okay, so what are we doing about it? The good news is a lot of groups are concerned and a lot of groups are doing something about it. For example, we were able to stop one of the partnership programs called the Global Sustainable Development Facility. Our alliance, I think, is very powerful. It's made up of northern and southern groups with a wide range of concerns. Some of them are represented here. We want to do three things. One is we want to focus on the corporations. If the UN won't monitor them, we will. By joining these partnerships, the companies have invited us to do additional scrutiny of their behavior, and that's what we're going to do. Second, we're going to support the right relationship. It's not partnership, but regulation. And we can do that at the UN Subcommission on Promotion and Protection of Human Rights, because they're studying how to regulate, how to develop a code of conduct, which might eventually be binding on corporations. And three, we have to expose the ideology of the Global Compact as corporate-driven. Kofi Annan says that open markets are the best chance for the poor. But what he doesn't tell you is that open markets, is what it really sounds nice, actually refers to the rules of the WTO. The very rules, the very ideology that the Seattle movement, which we could call Seattle movement for short, is fighting against. So for him, at this moment, shortly after Seattle, to say that open markets is our only chance and globalization is our only chance is a betrayal of all of us, all the whole Seattle movement, labor, community, and health that are fighting so hard against that very same ideology. Now, doing all this criticism of the UN and Kofi Annan and so forth, we have to walk a tightrope. We're supporters of the UN, of its values. We believe those values of peace and democracy and human rights should be placed above the values of commercial interests. But the UN is weak. So bashing it is easy, but it doesn't really get us where we want to go, which is strengthening the role of its values in world governance. We have to increase our support for the UN, especially in the U.S., through a campaign to fully fund the U.S. without strings attached, without making it more business-friendly. And we also have to support the work of the various U.N. treaties and conventions that do hold corporations accountable to governments on environment and human rights issues. But we have to make it very clear that our support is not unconditional. It's conditional on it being free of corporations, of corporate influence. Our UN, a corporate-free UN, should not be a voice for corporate globalization, but for we the peoples. And that way, I can teach my children to go out and support UNICEF the way I did when we were collecting pennies as kids. Thank you very much.
That was Kenny Bruno, who works with the Transnational Resource Action Center and is the co-author of the pamphlet Tangled Up in Blue, Corporate Partnerships at the UN. Next up is Victoria Tauli Corpus, an indigenous activist from the Philippines. She comes from the Kankanay people in the Cordillera region. They gained worldwide fame when they stopped the Chico River Dam, a World Bank IMF project, in the mid-70s. She fights mining investments and the theft of indigenous knowledge by corporations and is coordinator of the Asian Indigenous Women's Network, Victoria Tauli Corpus.
In my talk today, I would just like to focus on what are the trends after Seattle and what are the responses that are coming from the local communities, from indigenous peoples in particular, and where should we be going from this time on. First of all, I think one of the things that I have found out in this after Seattle was that in spite of the fact that we have really blown up the whole issue of globalization and have shown that it is very much adversely affecting the poorest sections of society all over the world. The countries who have hardline positions, the powerful and mighty countries, are still persisting in their hardline positions in various UN meetings. And I have seen this, for instance, when there was this Beijing Plus 5 conference here in New York, and there was a lot of talk about how globalization has really impacted on women. The United States, at the end of that one-week conference, when the outcomes document was released, the United States single-handedly stood up and expressed its reservation on one particular aspect of the document. And this was the sentence which says that economic globalization has caused tremendous poverty for women all over the world. The Ambassador Betty King said that they have reservations of that because they don't believe that globalization has caused poverty for women. You know, and so that's put into record, and in fact, the women's groups have printed out that particular reservation. The other one was during the Social Summit Plus 5, which was held in Geneva just recently. And in this meeting, I was so shocked when I saw the way this the U.S., particularly Canada and the EU, are behaving, because they were the ones who were really very strongly opposing a sentence on the need for a currency transaction tax. This is the proposal of the different countries, even especially by the G77 countries, which should really tax this currency foreign exchange transactions, like, for instance, the Tobin tax. The Tobin tax is one example. And this was not passed, because of the strong opposition from the U.S. And what was there was just to create a working group to study the possibility of a currency transaction tax. That was that, and that only came in because there was really a strong lobby from the NGOs who were present, and of course also from the other governments. But the most scandalous for me was when there was a phrase saying that foreign colonization or occupation should be stopped because this is a main impediment to social development. And the U.S. again stood up and said, no, we don't like that statement to be there in the document. And all the other countries, even those who are really colonizers or interveners, like for instance Iraq, Kuwait, even Russia, they stood up to say that they didn't, they still would like that particular paragraph to be there. And until I think Oman, one of the countries, stood up and said, if the United States is not for this particular sentence, what is the United States for? You know, obviously, the United States is for colonization and foreign intervention, and that really was very clear in that meeting. And so, and for me, it's really a situation where you can see that the powers of these countries are really very much dominant, even within the UN, and it's not any surprise that things like the Global Compact and all this can be seen within the UN because of this tremendous influence and domination wielded by such countries. I was here when the Global Compact was launched in the United Nations, and it was really so depressing to see all these huge, powerful multinational corporations being there, you know, and of course presenting a very good image. And so we were able to raise very, very strongly our protest, and particularly from indigenous peoples. Many of these corporations are really the corporations who have been instrumental in violating the rights of indigenous peoples to their lands. Like, for instance, you talk about Rio Tinto Zinc or Shell Corporation, even Bayer Corporation, who has manufactured all those pesticides which are now causing a lot of problems in many of our communities. So this is the situation that we have now, and I think the challenges that we need to do are tremendous. First of all, I don't think we are not still giving up on the United Nations. Much as we know that they are having this partnership with the corporations, they are doing all this, even the UN specialized agencies are having their own partnerships. I think it is our role to still insist and assert that the United Nations is not a body that should be giving priority to corporations, nor to the interests of the very powerful countries. The indigenous peoples have been lobbying very hard for the creation of a permanent forum on indigenous peoples in the United Nations, because in the past, our concerns have been only dealt at the lowest level of the UN. And last 2 weeks ago, we were able to get the ECOSOC Commission to approve the resolution for the creation of the permanent forum on indigenous issues within the United Nations. We think that we should also persist in really criticizing all the global compact of Kofi Annan with the corporations. One of the alliances that has been created outside of the global compact is an alliance with the WHO of the corporations, and they call themselves the Global Alliance for Community Health. And the partners are the mining corporations, which are destroying the health and the environmental health in our communities. So I think this is an example of the most absurd kind of alliance that you can think of. How can mining corporations be helping in bringing about community health when in fact they are the ones polluting our rivers and even destroying the sources of water in many of our communities? So I think that we have to persist. We cannot afford to stop criticizing the UN in terms of how it's promoting these kinds of partnership. Thirdly, I think the statement that was brought out by many of our friends, of which we are the signatory, the statement on the WTO shrink or sink, is a very important statement which really captures the main demands that we have on the WTO. Fourth, I think we should continue in cutting back the powers of the World Bank and the IMF. the domination of the World Bank and the IMF in terms of designing the policies, the socioeconomic policies in our country should really be removed. I don't think that the World Bank has any moral authority, nor the IMF has any moral authority to continue designing our social and economic policies in whichever ever country we come from. And finally, I think we should continue strengthening our solidarity with each other, particularly in supporting the local protests and the efforts of the local people to organize themselves. Because more and more, because of the backlash, we are really being threatened by militarization and also by all these human rights violations taking place. And in the past, we sort of forgot already the issue of human rights violation because of all these other issues that came in. But in the Philippines, we are seeing more arbitrary arrests, more militarization, and in fact, even communities which are really very much intact are now being destroyed. They are being dislocated from their communities because of the military operations. And there's a need to strengthen the solidarity with the movements for human rights defense and the movements to defend the land and lives of indigenous peoples. I think this is we really need to strengthen this because many of the protests against globalization now is really happening in indigenous peoples' communities. And many of the alternatives to globalization are also seen in indigenous peoples' communities. And therefore, it is important for us to be able to give our strong support to this because otherwise, the alternatives that we are talking of will really not be seen in any of the communities that are still very much vibrant and dynamic. And we look forward to more support from all of you. Thank you very much.
That was Victoria Tali Corpus, indigenous activist from the Cordillera region in the Philippines. She works with the Indigenous Peoples International Center for Policy Research and Education. This is the second program in an 8-part series on the complicity of the leadership of the United Nations with globalization and corporations. It was recorded in September of 2000 in New York, at the teach-in of the International Forum on Globalization. You can get the double program on corporate underwriting and the global water crisis for $12. The transcript of this full 4-hour series is $12 as well. For a credit card order, call us toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE and let us know if you want the transcript or the tape. That's 1-877-TUC-TAPE. Or send your $12 check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.